This is episode 130 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, your host, and that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world every single week.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He's most well known for his Smile Maker and his amazing Smile Maker studio. His greatest passion is that you might use his tools and products to share fun and encouragement. Variety artist, I give you Barry Mitchell.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How's it going, Barry?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. We're going to start right off here. Is it true that your career started because of the loan of a dime?
Yes, it is, in reality. When I was 9 years old, I got interested in magic. My uncle was really nice to share one of his passions, which was puzzles and brain teasers. And whenever he would come to visit, he always had something like that to show me. And it somehow got me interested. And there was a few other kids in my community that liked magic as well. I had a dollar and went to we called it the White Way. It was like a local variety store, or when I was a kid, they were called dime stores. And went to the store, and there was a magic set. And oh, it's the most wonderful magic set. Now you would look at it and think, oh my gosh, that's even worse than what you would get at a Dollar Tree. But it was probably 99 cents or a dollar, something like that. And that's all I had, was a dollar. So I did not have enough money to get it. I was just standing there looking and wanting this, oh, so wonderful magic set. And some gentleman was walking by and saw me lusting after this magic set and said, are you going to get it? I said, no, I don't have enough money. And he gave me a dime to have enough money to pay the tax. And so that gentleman started my magic career. And I have yet to ever forgive that man for putting me into this kind of debt load. So thank you, sir, for that dime.
Well, now, is that where you came up with your love of dollar stores? Because I've seen your lecture at CAX and other places, and I'm always fascinated by all the things that you put together at the dollar store. What are some of your favorite things that you get from the dollar store?
I want to clarify something here. It's not really that I love the dollar store that much, but I love the idea of being covered in stimuli and the ability to buy anything you see. You know, when you go into a hardware store and you see some oddity in the plumbing section, you go, oh boy, I would love to be able to take that home and play with that and see if we can come up with some use for it. But that little oddity is 20 bucks.
Right.
You just can't do that. But at the dollar store, you find some oddity and you can load up your basket and not feel that you've broken the budget and take it home and play. And play is really the key to creativity. And the dollar store just makes it easy to play.
Yeah, because all of a sudden you have 20 products in your cart instead of one.
Dollar store didn't exist when I was a kid, but now we have that advantage into being able to buy all those silly things and put them together into something potentially wonderful.
Well, what kind of silly things have you found that you've had success with?
I'll give you an example, and this was not from the dollar store. This was actually would have been 20 or more years ago, and the item was from Big Lots. I created a trick called Got Cookies. I created the trick because I actually created it for my audition for the Oreo Magician, which was a long time back. And for the audition, I wanted to do a double stuff or a sponge ball routine as part of the audition. So I took foam and cut it into a foam disc. And then for the cookie, I took the real Oreo cookie and I shellacked it several times to get it hard enough to be able to use it. And then I would squeeze the piece of foam between the two cookies to look like an Oreo cookie.
Yeah.
The name of the campaign was called Twist and Unlock the Magic. So if I'm holding that with a little tension, it looks like a genuine Oreo cookie. And then I do the little twist and release some of the pressure. And now it expands into a little foam stuff. And then I do a sponge ball routine in their hands. That was one of the things that helped me get the job. And then years later, I decided to market the trick with a white sponge ball as the stuff. And at Big Lots, I found a game that was plastic Oreo cookies. It was one of those matching games where all of the items are laying upside down and a child turns it over and he sees like a star or a moon or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Then he has to match it with another one that he's turned over. Well, I was able to grind all of that inside part off so that I had two legitimate Oreo named pieces of plastic. Had Oreo on the plastic, and it was just the perfect size for the white sponge ball, and I marketed a trick called Got Cookies. And so all of those plastic cookies that I bought at Big Lots eventually became tricks, because it only took one set, one cookie, to make the trick, and then all the other items went inside. So that seeing that toy at Big Lots inspired the entire trick. So you never know what you might see at a dollar store, or for that matter, anywhere.
I know Smile Maker, it's the one that I know. It seems to be the most popular, or one of the most popular. How did that all come about?
Smile Maker, well, actually, in a way, it goes back to when I made Boo Balls, B-O-O, Boo Balls.
Pardon, be careful how you say that.
Yeah, no, I wanted to spell it because I'm also from the South and people can't understand me anyway. I attended a Chris Carey lecture. I want to attribute a great deal of respect to Chris Carey and his book, Find the Stuff That's You, really was in many ways my Bible when I was younger, because there was so much creativity in the book, but not just creativity, the desire to push you to figure out who you are. Because in my life, I was different magicians as I was growing up. You know, you had your phase where you wanted to be an illusionist like David Copperfield. And then you looked in the mirror and realized you were, you know, a fat kid and you probably couldn't pull it off. But there's a point in time, hopefully, that you realize that's somebody else and you need to figure out who you are. And so Chris's influence in his book really helped me with that. But I saw him do the warm fuzzy story at a magic convention in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and it totally changed my life. It just was such a wonderful way to use sponge balls. I'm not sure if I had already studied this in college at the time. I'm not sure, but the warm fuzzy story, I believe, is by Carl Steiner. But we did study it when I was in college in a psychology class, and it's a great story. And the fact that Chris Carey put that together with sponge balls and a crystal casket is just very inspiring to me. I went back to the hotel room that night, and I wrote the patter for Boo Balls, which was really more about patter than it was about the trick. Eventually, the Boo Balls painted on them, actually screen printed them with a face. Point is that the Boo Balls became these little yellow printed balls.
Oh,
that was really the first smile that I'd put on the balls. Then fast forward 20 or 25 years, playing around with the idea of having several, like, 8 2-inch sponge balls compressed inside an Incrediball, which is the ball that turns inside out and gets bigger. So I was playing around with that idea, and the idea of bursting it open inside a paper bag. Just the process of playing and seeing what it would do and saying, you know what? What if I paint on a yellow one? And so I called Goshman and I said, okay, can you print me some or dye me some yellow ones? And he did, and it just took off. But ironically, the trick that I created originally was that you would pop the gimmick, and the first production was the big smile, and then you would pull out the little ones. So we sold it that way, and a customer sent me a message. I'm not sure who it was right now, but sent me a message, said, you know, I think it might be better. I'm using it where I pull out the small ones first and then the big one. I'm thinking, wow, what an idiot, Barry. That's such a better idea.
Why didn't I think of that?
And, you know, my whole career has been that way as far as the way we can connect with customers now. Used to, when I had a mail order company, you're not connecting the way we do with social media now. So people can tell me instantly, you know, here's what I did with the trick. And I go, wow, that's so much better.
Have you changed a lot of your tricks because of that?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Because people will give you ideas. And because of the fact that I have a website that has the videos of the products on it. So I would say that a gross generalization would be that on most magic shop websites, there will be a video that shows you what the trick does.
Yeah.
So my product might have 5 or 6 videos to show you what the product does. Because every time I write a new routine for it, I put a video up of it.
Oh.
It's not unusual for me to, you know, after the product's been out for a year, to have a new idea and shoot another video and add it to the website.
Sure.
But, you know, when I do that, we always advertise it in the newsletter and Facebook and all that stuff to say that we had a new idea. But I love the fact that this object that you originally had the idea to do this one thing can end up doing a dozen things, and you hit that point where you say, okay, it can do no more. And then, oh my goodness, it can do another thing. And that is just the most thrilling part of what I do, because it's all just play. I mean, in reality, it's just play. And when you stop playing, then obviously that item can only do that one thing.
You and Michael Troutman, I think, said the exact same thing you're saying. When you get a new product, a new prop, a new piece of gack, whatever it may be, play with it, because you never know all the different things that you can do with it.
This Michael guy's really smart.
Well, Michael Troutman, he does an entire 45-minute routine with a ping pong ball, ping pong balls.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane.
A tremendous amount of creativity.
It is. And it sounds like you're from that same school.
I might have been on a different side of the track, but yeah, maybe so.
By the way, one of my questions to you is, I love that you do video for every project. Tell me your philosophy about that. You just did.
Oh, okay, good.
See, so you're a mind reader too.
Nobody's ever accused me of that, but thank you.
All right. Now, what is SmileMakerStudio.com?
Over the years, it's actually been over 40 years at this point, although I do look very young for my age. Over the years, I've created a lot of products, a lot of DVDs, and content, books and such as that. I just said, I need one place that has it all. This started with simply the idea of recording some videos. We call them VIP video. And these were just ideas for tricks or routines, and they were free to watch on our Facebook group. And they became pretty popular, and people were watching them. Somewhere along the line, I said, you know, what if we put all of this content, but included all of my DVDs? So everything I've ever done in my lifetime in one location. Videos are still free for people to watch. If you're a what's called a visitor member of the studio, then you can join as a visitor member for free. That simply means that you opened an account with your email. If you're a paid member, then you have access to all the DVD content. And there's now over 1,000 videos, all of my books and magazine articles. And every time we do a lecture now, so like you said, you saw me at CACS in California.
Yep.
If we got video of that, then it's in the studio. I really try to put everything in the studio. So that's what that is.
So if I'm a paid member, I can watch all those videos anytime I want?
Yes, it is a streaming service. You also get 10% off at our store anytime. And then we have a secret Facebook group as well.
Sure. I mean, someone invests in a product and they put on your Facebook, guess what I did with this product?
Yeah. And I like that because that opens up a whole new world. You know, J.R. Russell is a good fellow out in the Northwest.
Yep.
He came to me at Kadabra. He had picked up a round close-up pad at someone else's booth, And he showed it to me. He said, you know, this might work good in the little pop-up can that's part of the pop-up production trick. It was like, wow, this opened up a whole new world. And I can't tell you the number of tricks that have come about because of JR sharing that simple idea with me.
Now, if someone were to want to kind of get their feet wet and never used your products before, would you suggest a specific product or a couple of products that they would start with?
No, because I think people ought to look for something that fits their personality. Mm. If I said, oh yeah, you should look at the Smile Maker trick, that just might not be you. I would rather people go to the website. There's tons of videos on the product website and look around. There are tricks that I have that are more popular than others. I really think it depends on who you are.
Well, now most people know you for all of your products and BarryMitchellProducts.com, but you have quite an extensive performing background, right? Tell us about that.
I've been doing that for a while, yeah.
For a day or two?
Where I grew up in Tennessee, the biggest market for me was churches. Then I did an audition for, I did the Oreo Magician, and then there was another one that was, I think, International Home Foods, or not sure of the company name, but it was the Chef Boyardee company. And they were similar to Oreo Magician, because they were sending you into a grocery store to do magic tricks and get people to buy spaghetti. You know, I had those type of jobs. But then the thing that really changed everything for me was I auditioned for the Dixie Stampede, which is a dinner attraction in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Would be considered a hillbilly Vegas. Yeah. So we've got shows and shopping and the mountains and Dollywood. Dolly Parton is from Sevierville, Tennessee. And so the Dollywood theme park is here. So we are a tourist destination for the Southeast. That's where I picked up the job as the comedian at the Dixie Stampede. Now, Dixie Stampede is no longer called that. It is now called Dolly's Stampede. It was a political correctness name change. The show is the same, great fun, and I had the privilege of being in that show for 4 years and then a couple more years opening for some country music stars here in Pigeon Forge.
You said comedian, so you weren't doing any magic? Was it all straight comedy?
Well, when the role first started, we did both the saloon show and the arena show. They seated 1,000 people a show, and we would do 2 or sometimes 3 shows a day.
Oh, wow.
So we did a show in the saloon, which was basically the waiting area while we were getting the arena ready, because it's a horse and animal show along with a dinner.
Okay.
So our saloon show was to keep them interested, but yet to be entertaining. My character was a con man originally. So I used magic and jokes. And then we did some music and different things, comedy stuff in the show. But then my character went with the audience. And so I was the con man in the arena show as well. And so we had an illusion that was created by Franz Ferrari. We called it the barrel trick. But basically, we used twins and had a girl supposedly chosen from the audience to go come into the arena, get into a barrel, mix up the barrels, and then she ends up disappearing and reappearing in the audience.
Anybody who saw that and is listening to this, they're like, oh, he just gave away the secret. Oh, no.
You know, I thought about that as I was saying it, and I thought, you know.
I'm not sure if I should cut that out or not.
I can't really take this back now.
So, yeah, well, I might cut that out. I'm not sure. Did you want to describe it again? And just describe it without giving it away?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to listen to this. It's going to care, do you?
I don't think so.
Okay, let's just leave it in.
Okay, here we go. We got it.
We didn't give them too much information.
That's right.
Changed over the years, but you know, that particular illusion is just so popular. I mean, it's been 25 years since I was the comedian there. So this trick has seen its day. I don't know what Fran Zerari's deal was, but if he's getting residuals, he should be in a really big house by now.
He's getting that check for $1.29 every couple of weeks.
Well, if he does, then it ought to be adding up. So that'd be nice.
Yeah. All right, we're going to move on to fact or something John just made up. Sound like fun?
Okay, great.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to give you a headline, and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little more about it.
Okay.
Here we go. First headline. Barry wore a dress for 6 years.
That is true.
Wait, true?
Actually, it would be more than that, because before I was at Dixie Stampede in Pigeon Forge, I was in Gatlinburg at another attraction that I had forgotten about until you just asked that question. So I actually wore a dress then as well, but it was part of a bit I did called The Wedding Song. I would wear the dress. We would bring someone from the audience that, unbeknownst to them, did not realize they were about to sing with me. So we played it up that they were going to be singing a love song with a pretty lady. And of course, it's a pretty lady that brings them up. And then, of course, it switches and I come out and we do this comedy bit. So I did that all 4 years at Dixie, and then did it in both of the shows I did after that with some other guys. So 6 years wearing a dress.
I know this is a funny question. Did you ever go home and just go, well, maybe I'll try that on?
No, actually, I didn't. No.
Good answer.
There's anything wrong with that, but it just wasn't me.
All right, next headline. Barry cut his performing teeth as a ventriloquist.
Oh, that's a great question. Completely false.
Oh.
Yeah, I am not a ventriloquist. I've had some very nice people say some very nice things that they felt that I would be a good ventriloquist if I chose to study that. I think that's very kind. That's just not my passion. I want to work the puppet. I don't mind my lips moving. I thank Tim Sonnefeld for giving me the courage to let my lips move and work the puppet. So I am not a ventriloquist.
So you have a puppet in your act?
We have two puppets. We have Sam the Turtle and Hyena the Laughing Chicken, and they are the stars of the show to such an extent that when it comes to the schools and the library shows, I don't really market myself. Everything is coming from Sam the Turtle. He's the star of the show. In the advertising, it's starring Sam the Turtle and Hyena the Chicken, co-starring Mr. Barry.
How do you avoid the kids yelling, oh, his lips are moving?
Well, that's a good question. I was in fear of that. So I wrote some jokes to be prepared for them to say that, and they didn't.
No.
I could probably count on my hands the number of times some kid has yelled out, your lips are moving. Probably not more than 10 times. And I've been doing them for years. They just don't do it. Now, I'm assuming that if you were really bad at working the puppet, or you spoke and 2 seconds later the puppet opened his mouth, I'm assuming they might complain. Right. But if you're decent at working the puppet and your voice is different enough, I don't think they notice.
And I'll bet if you look like you're trying to not move your lips, but you are, then that would be a problem.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to give some credit to the puppet itself. I use the Axtell puppets. They are just so good, such quality. You know, the character of the puppet looks so good that pulls your eye in. So if that puppet is moving and you've got the audience, they're paying more attention to the puppet. And even me, I know what I'm doing. When I watch the video of my performances, I can't look at me because the puppet is appealing. If I focus on me, I'll go, gosh, that looks bad. Your lips are moving. But you just can't. I mean, there's too much fun from the look of the puppet. So big props to Steve Axtell for making me look good for a long time.
Anybody that is interested in using puppets, go to Axtell's website, axtellexpressions.com, I believe.
Yeah, and I think it's you can just do axtell.com as well.
All right, last headline. Barry became a comedian when an appearing cane flew out of his hand into the audience.
That's true. Actually, I was a comedian before that. I worked with the Fantasio Canes and Candles a lot when I was in high school. I had what I consider to be a really nice routine. And so I had a show where I had decided in my mind, okay, last year's show at this venue got such great response off of my standard comedy bits. And this was, I would have been maybe a freshman or sophomore in college when this happened. I said, I was so hot last year that this year I'm going to show the Canes and Candles and I'm going to do a smooth act.
Yeah.
I step on stage and the candles are working beautifully. And then I have a silk in my hand and I give it a wave and a Walsh appearing cane is going to appear in the hand. I will twirl it, toss it to the other hand and take a pose of my incredible skill. And I waved the silk and it shot out of my hand like a rocket into the audience and people were ducking. And then I just went, ta-da.
You're like, thank you.
I guess I sold the candles. I can't find them anymore.
That was fact. Or something John just made up.
You want some fan questions there, Barry?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, we got a couple of fans, some people you know. Steve Petra, one of the top puppeteers in the country, terrific interview on episode 35, by the way. He just begged me to ask, Barry, can you tell us how you use the concept of a show faux?
Well, Steve is far smarter than I am. He used the word protagonist a lot. And that's one of them $2 words. I tend to go for the 25-cent words. What I've discovered is, through the help of many people, of course, that the real key to children's entertainment is some conflict. Steve talks about how the conflict you have with the puppets and the back and forth, and that gets the kids excited. So for me, I call it a foe, and I need a foe, but not just the puppet is my foe, but an object in the show is the foe. And I realized after this summer that I can have multiple foes in the show. So in my show, I don't like pickles. So it's clearly posted there will be no pickles in the show. And then, of course, Sam the Turtle constantly finds places to hide pickles. So I'm doing a production of something out of some box. And then the last thing I do is look inside and I go, oh, I can't believe it. It's a pickle. I knew it. Sam does this every time. So, with kids, they just think that's really funny. I assume, I don't do high school students, but I assume if I did that in high school, they would think I was an idiot. That's why I don't do high schools. So that pickle is my foe. And I think you have to find something like that for children's entertainers to really create that opportunity for a running gag. So it keeps popping up. And in the show that I'm going to be writing for, I'm writing right now for the Christmas virtual show. Once again, pickles will be my foe, and I'm really excited about the finale of the show. I'm actually going to be a giant pickle. I ordered a pickle costume, and Sam is forcing me, he's blackmailing me that I have to tell the pickle story in the pickle costume.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's really silly. It's absurd. But that foe creates the fun. And so you've got to find the foe for your show to be even more fun for the kids.
You have to find your show foe.
That's it.
Chris Johnson, an amazing school assembly entertainer out of Niagara, says, In a world where there's so much low quality crap peddled to magicians, what steps did you take to get the right vendors to manufacture everything at such a high level?
Well, you know, most of the stuff that I put out is stuff that I make, unless it's something like where I'm taking a sponge product that Goshman makes and I'm turning that into something, or I'm painting it or combining it in such a way that it becomes a different trick. So in that case, you know, I'm going to go to the guy that makes the best sponge, which is Goshman. In the case of the stuff that I make, I'm just a perfectionist to some level, OCD. I would say that some people would say that I'm more OCD than I believe I am. Everything has my name on it. Because my name on it, it's really important. And I have a very simple belief about everything I do, that it's all about relationships. The business that I have is because of the relationship I've created with the magicians or whoever, variety artists that buy my stuff. So we have a relationship in the same way that I have relationships with the librarians and the teachers that hire me. Building that relationship, you're building that trust. So if they buy something and it's not good, then I'm harming my name. And there is a chance that they will not contact me and say, I don't like this. That's the worst possible scenario. If they don't tell you they don't like it, they will tell someone else. So I need to do everything I can to put a good product in their hands. And if it's not a good product, somebody needs to tell me so that I can fix it or stop selling it. You know, we had a product a while back that I introduced. Some customers sent me some ideas and said, you know, this, it's doing this and it's doing that. And I go, you know what? That's bad. Wasn't supposed to do that. I said, I'm going to send you a replacement. So I had to send replacements to every customer that had ordered that product. But it's a relationship. I can't break that relationship. So it's important to me, even if I lose money on replacing those things, the relationship is more important than the money. Because if you have the relationship, the money will come.
All right, Eddie Rice Jr. Of A1 Best Events. Oh, and Lee Andrews, one of the funniest clowns you'll ever see out of Georgia. They ask kind of the same question. How do you go about getting the kids interested when you're doing a message show, balancing the funny with the message?
Well, one of the ways is to do what we just talked about, to have a foe, have something that they know it's going to happen again. Once you've established that you don't like pickles, and we've seen two pickles in the show, they know it's going to happen. There's going to be another pickle at some point. So they're always ready for that next item. So when you write your show, write those things in so that they're looking for it. You know, we know how to tease kids to get them to talk back to us, which is what we want. We want that interaction between us and the audience, which is why it's difficult during this COVID season. When we're not doing live shows, we don't have that interaction, and that makes it very difficult.
Right.
But if they're with you and you're providing those things to keep their interest, then they will listen to whatever message you need to get out. But then also, I think it's important to really find a way to make the message easy to go down. And that is the hardest thing in the world. I mean, it's real easy. I used to make a joke 30 years ago to say that people would do a school show and they'll come in and do a magic show. And then at the end say, by the way, don't do drugs.
Right.
Well, that's not an educational show. And you haven't helped anybody but yourself, and only once, because more than likely you're not going to get hired again. So finding a way to put a message in with your entertainment really takes some time and some scripting. And I'm real big on scripting. I don't do anything that's not scripted other than this. You know, what we're doing now is not scripted. So I'm not, I may miss something grammatically here and there, and I may be too long-winded because I'm not scripted. But if I'm on stage, it's all scripted.
Who was it? Was it Romani? Romani said, you cut it once and then you cut it a second time, and then you cut more and you cut it until it's down to the bare bones and keep cutting until you have the funniest part.
Yeah, yeah. And with the punchline being at the end as opposed to somewhere too early. Finding the position of the word that creates the laugh so that it is at the end of the sentence.
I do the exact same thing. That is absolutely true. You use the word that is the punchline for the sentence for the last word of the sentence. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it can be very tough rewriting over and over, but I think that's the mark. I think that's what, you know, it's not like you're going to call a client and say, you know, I make sure that the punchline is the last word, you know?
Yeah.
But hopefully they're going to go, oh, that was a fun show. And so they buy it again. And they don't know what all went into getting that fun show. You know, I can watch another performer performing and hear something they say. And in my mind, I go, man, if he had put that word here, you know, just move that, it would have got a bigger reaction. But getting there takes some work.
If you could leave everybody with one suggestion about creativity, what would it be?
That's a great question. I would probably say that when we think about creativity, we hear people say, well, you're really creative. I wish I was that creative. And it's disappointing when you hear that because everyone is creative. We do it in different ways. We have to survive because it's problem solving. The difference is in my line of work, I'm doing it all the time because I'm creating magic tricks or creating shows. So yeah. I like this thought, and that is that limitation breeds creativity and play feeds creativity.
Wait. Say it again.
Limitation, because we're all going to have limits into what we can get across. For example, with COVID, we're limited in how we can interact with our audience. So that means we are forced to be more creative. So limitations breeds creativity, but play feeds our creativity. And by that, I mean, okay, we know we've found a creative solution here, but now when we play with that solution, it gets even better. So play feeds it.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, thanks for doing my show. That was great, man. That was great. That was really fun. Super fun.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Now, before I let you go, do you have any social media, websites, that type of thing we can go to? Well, smilemakers.com, right?
Yeah, smilemakerstudio.com is the subscription site. BarryMitchellProducts.com is the product website. And if they're interested in seeing my children's show site, it's BarryMitchellShows.com. And so you can see how I market my shows. And then, of course, remember, my puppet is the star of the show, so he also has his own website, and that is samtheturtle.com, so you can check out those things. And then we have fans and friends of Barry Mitchell Products on Facebook is our group, and Barry Mitchell Products has a page as well.
All right, thanks to all my Variety artists. Tell all your friends about the Variety Artist Podcast. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.